All right, welcome to Modern Thirst Radio. This is our very first podcast. I'm Bill Straub, and with me is Matt Gates. We are the brains, if you want to call it that, behind modernthirst.com. Matt, how you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. This is really exciting. I can't wait to share our knowledge via voice now.
Yeah, this is going to be a lot of fun. We've talked about this for a long time. I guess just to give some listeners some background, since not everyone's really familiar with us, we'll just talk a little bit about Modern Thirst. Really started, we just had our second anniversary, our second birthday, so we're pretty excited about that. A couple of years ago, I think Matt and I were just putting our heads together on talking about different projects and things that we like to do, and we've both always really been into Kentucky bourbon and craft beer, I guess is the best way to say it. We just decided that modernthirst.com, a blog, was kind of a great way to really express that, kind of a creative outlet for what we really enjoyed.
It was really a great way to do that because we've been talking and texting back for years just about what we're drinking, and I think that we drink so many good things and have so many good insights. It was fun to just document some of it, and people seem to be enjoying it. I mean, it's hard to believe that it's been 2 years. And thinking back to how our site looked at then, it was kind of pathetic, but it quickly grew to look really, really nice.
Yeah, we've kind of exploded a little more than I thought. We've passed 1 million page views well before our second birthday, as a matter of fact. And I think that's kind of extraordinary. I feel like we've really kind of developed a bit of a loyal following, and we really appreciate it. Along those lines, we also have a third partner in Modern Thirst. His name is also Bill. His last name is Scott rather than Straub. So we just refer to him as Other Bill. He's really the creative guy behind Modern Thirst. He runs Scott Strategic out of Detroit, Michigan, a suburb of Detroit, which is a full-service marketing and advertising and creative design firm. So Bill kind of put together our website and has been instrumental in developing the look of Modern Thirst, and we'll certainly have him involved with all aspects of the company, I guess you would say, going forward. Speaking of that, I guess we kind of got our start doing mostly bourbon reviews and tasting notes, and that's mainly just because I really kind of enjoy writing an awful lot, probably more than is conducive to a good work and home life. But so over those 2 years, I've basically put together tasting notes on over 100 different whiskeys. It's almost all American whiskey. In fact, I think it's all American whiskey at this point. But it's a mix of bourbon and rye and a couple other whiskeys like wheat whiskeys and such. And then recently, of course, having a resident beermeister on hand like Matt Gates, we decided to start incorporating some of Matt's handiwork in his ratings of different craft beers over the last couple of years as well. And you might have noticed that on the site, though, it's called Matt's Beer Ratings. And Matt, tell us a little bit about your beer ratings.
Well, it is an honor to be called a beer meister. That's probably one of my most crowning achievements. But actually, I think Untappd, one of the first things I ever wrote on Modern Thirst was I recommended people to get Untappd a couple years ago. And I realized I've actually been Untappd for about almost 4 years now. But I was doing basically like tireless work by accumulating check-ins on Modern Thirst. And it was something kind of behind the scenes. And you're right, we really needed to have some craft beer content on here. So it was fun to put it on there. As far as the ratings go, I think this is somewhat a work in progress. How I've rated them previously is I've kind of tended to do it based on style. So if you see something that's rated a 4, you know, over a 4-star out of 5, that's going to be a fantastic rating. But that generally means if it's an IPA, that means it's a top IPA. Or let's compare it a little bit different to stouts. I like stouts a lot. They're not my go-to drink. So if I have a stout and I rate that high, it might be one of the best stouts I've ever had. However, there's an IPA out there that might be rated 3.5 that I might like better than that. So that's something that we may tweak that going forward. I kind of want to see what people think. It kind of as we have some conversations with people. But I think it's a good start there. I think we could do some secondary ratings, and if I really want to stack rank them all based regardless of style, would be kind of a fun thing to do too.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think it's very similar to how we've rated bourbon. I don't necessarily rate it based on my preference of what I like to drink, but really whether it's a good representation of what it is. Is it a good, you know, 10-year-old well-balanced bourbon versus a good, well-balanced 10-year-old rye whiskey? You know, I'm almost always going to prefer the bourbon over the rye whiskey, but the rating is based on whether it's a well-executed version of what it is. And I do that just so that it's a little more objective, but I think that in my comments, I usually make it known whether I'm absolutely in love with something that I'm rating and reviewing, or whether it's, you know, just a very good, solid choice. It's got to be a little different on the beer, obviously, since it's not really a lot of commentary. It's more just data.
Right. And I think with a more limited universe of bourbons and whiskeys out there, you've been able to put together a pretty comprehensive review list. Certainly not all encompassing, but there's a tremendous amount of a high percentage of the bourbons out there you've reviewed. That's almost impossible with a beer, especially with how craft beer is boomed. So
I've only rated about 1,000. So God, don't know how much time it would take you to write a full blown review on each of those.
Yeah, and that's such a small percentage of the beers out there. I mean, there's new breweries open every day. So I don't think you're going to come to Modern Thirster. Look,
with 1,000 beers rated, being a resident beer meister must be really tough work.
It is tiring. I mean, I constantly get questioned on why I smell like hops, but it's certainly enjoyable though. I'm glad I was, pointed to this task.
Well, we think you're handling it pretty well. We've also moved on to, hopefully some folks have been to our site at modernthirst.com, but they may have noticed that not only is Matt our resident beer meister, but he also does talk about and review bourbon at times as well. And recently we added our very first videos to the site, and those were some video reviews that you did with the Party Source in Northern Kentucky. And there were three different Wild Turkey variants that you reviewed on video. They were posted to YouTube, and we linked them on our own site. How did that come about?
Well, obviously, with being a beer meister and running a bourbon blog as well, you tend to visit some liquor stores and made some friendships at the Party Source. The Party Source is actually, to give them a little plug, they are the world's largest, America's largest liquor store, and I think that basically they did recently, they expanded some square footage, and they have a full-service brewery in there. They're opening a craft distillery outside, too. So there's, square footage-wise, it's a pretty amazing place. But part of this expansion, they added a bourbon tasting bar, and I've been there a few times. It's nice to be able to try a quick tasting of something that you might not be able to find a whole bottle of. And so I kind of made friends with Jonathan Owen. He goes by J.O. He's actually just kind of got promoted to really running things over there at the bar. And he started this video series, and I think I kind of took note. I thought it was neat. And he invited us to come on. And actually, Bill, I meant to tell you, he wants you to come on. I think you might be coming up for something else here in a couple weeks. Maybe we can incorporate that too. But I think it's just nice to do a quick video review. You know, something, you know, I think it was ran about three or four minutes. So something where kind of a quick hitter and give somebody some more information on a tasting.
Sounds like it's a lot of fun. Hopefully we can both be involved with that again in the future. Do you have anything else in concrete planned with them? Any future reviews recorded and waiting to be posted or anything like that?
Nothing in the queue yet, but I actually have a message I need to return from him about some dates to do it. He's there most every day. And we just go upstairs. There's a little room. He has a little studio set up. So you can knock them out pretty quickly. While we kind of spread those reviews over weeks where we rolled them out, we actually reviewed four bourbons, and it was less than an hour. So it was a fun little thing to knock out. And we can kind of do it whenever we want, I think.
Well, that sounds pretty cool. I know we've had some discussions about filming a few of those ourselves as well. And that's, I would say, future plans for expanding the LLC behind Modern Thirst, that's probably one of the big ones, I think, is some video reviews, just because it's much like this podcast, it's a medium we haven't really reached yet. And speaking of that, the reason that we're actually recording this podcast is, again, not everyone has the ability to, you know, if you're commuting or on a bus or something like that, you can't always scroll through a website and read reviews. But there's a lot of people that like to listen to and talk about and read about the good life, as I like to call it, with bourbon and craft beer. So this is a way to kind of reach out to some of that demographic that we're not hitting just through a website and through a blog. And in terms of future plans for the business, we actually do have some concrete plans set up, and we can't be too specific, or I guess we really shouldn't be too specific yet, but we've had several different entities reach out to us and ask about consulting services, both on opening new bars, developing some menu items and some flight lists on bourbons that we've actually already done. And what I guess the next exciting plan is that we're going to be involved with the naming and branding and launching of a new bourbon, consulting on that here within the next few weeks, as a matter of fact. So we're pretty excited about that, and that should bring me up to Cincinnati in the near future.
Yeah, I'm real pumped about that. It's kind of a neat way to be in a different avenue of the business. I think over these 2 years and even before that, we got to explore many things by going on distillery tours and just kind of seeing behind the scenes on some things. But to kind of be part of the branding process will be something new. And I hope we can, going forward, as far as other things we could roll out, doing some barrel picks. That's something actually we can talk to the Party Source about as well. They've talked about doing that with us. They've done it with other people as well. And I just need to reconnect with them about that. But we'd like to do kind of some barrel picks too.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot of fun. I think that's something we definitely have been aiming for from the start, and I guess the logistics of putting it together are really the main reason it hasn't happened yet, but hopefully that will be in the near future. Speaking of what we're drinking, what are you drinking right now?
Well, I've actually been staring at this beer. I was like, maybe I'd open it on the microphone. I don't know if it's going to come through there, but I don't know. Can't believe we waited about 12 minutes here before we did this, but I'm drinking a bomber, a bomber of Arctic Panzer Wolf. This is from Three Floyds, and we can talk a little bit more about Three Floyds here. I think obviously most people that know craft beer know Three Floyds out of Munster, Indiana, out of Chicago. They make some amazing beers. They were kind of the hipster beer for a while because nobody could get it. I think they've expanded production a little bit, so you're seeing it a little bit more often now. They make a lot of great things. The Arctic Panzer Wolf's an Imperial IPA. So they really like to go crazy with the hops like many brewers. But on the flip side of that, they do have one of the most sought-after beers ever. It's called Dark Lord, and they have a Dark Lord Fest, and it's an Imperial Barrel Aged Stout, which that seems to be a popular rare beer for breweries to roll out. So actually, I'm lucky enough to have one of those bottles that's sitting in my refrigerator right now. It's aged for a while already, so I could drink that anytime. Maybe I'll save it for when you come up here, but right now I'm going to enjoy this Arctic Panzer Wolf.
Especially given the weather, the Arctic Panzer Wolf sounds like a great great choice. It's been snowing like crazy here in Louisville, so I assume it's similar.
Yes, it is. Yes,
Cincinnati.
Kind of that white death. We're on the fringe of it, so I think you're getting worse of that. But you should look at the logo for this Arctic Panzer Wolf. It's kind of a creepy looking wolf. They've kind of stuck with a almost like a heavy metal like album cover as far as their beer label. So it's kind of fun.
Well, I'm sipping on some Elijah Craig. This is a bottle I bought a couple of years ago. It still has the big red 12 on the front of it, which just gives me a warm, fuzzy feeling inside every time I see it. And really, I chose this because of the news in the last week that Elijah Craig has dropped the age statement from its label. And I think it's really a shame that this has happened. I know almost a year ago, we noticed and reported on the site that the big red 12 had been removed from the front, that denoting the 12 years of age for Elijah Craig. But it had been moved to the back label. It still said it was 12 years old. And we reached out to Heaven Hill, who makes Elijah Craig, as did other writers. And everyone was assured that they were not changing the age statement. They weren't dropping it. It was just a matter of trying to make the labels match the other iterations of Elijah Craig. But Fred Minnick just reported this past week that not only has that been moved to the back, it's now been dropped. And it's going to be a mixture of 8 to 12-year-old bourbons. I actually went to the liquor store yesterday to grab a couple of them that were still age stated, and all of the 750 milliliter bottles had the age removed from the back as well already. So essentially, Elijah Craig 12-year-old is dead, and I think that's a real shame. If you know, I have probably over 100 bourbons in my basement. I don't really collect it, but that's just what I've bought through wanting to review it for the website and for different gifts and reasons I've received bottles. If I had to name my favorite bourbon prior to today, it would have been Elijah Craig 12 year. $30 and 12 years old. It's a fantastic tasting bourbon. It was readily available, and it was far and away the best way for the average Joe to taste a premium aged Kentucky bourbon, and that's gone now. I think that's really a shame. I don't see myself buying it in the future because I think Heaven Hill already makes a younger aged Elijah Craig, and they call it Evan Williams. It's a slightly different proof, but you know, Heaven Hill claims that this is necessary to grow the brand because of the number of barrels they have aging and the ability to maintain 12 years. And you know, from a business standpoint, I guess they can make the decisions they need to make, but I think from a consumer standpoint, it's really a shame. You know, I think that their reasoning for this would be like Cadillac offering a junky 4-cylinder engine and plastic interior and telling everyone, well, that's the way we grow the brand, but we're still going to charge you the same for the Cadillac. You know, I just think it's a shame.
I really do, too.
I will actually raise my glass of Elijah Craig to the death of what has made Elijah Craig great.
So, rest in peace, Big Red 12. I need to get back out to the stores and see what I can find, because for a while I was still seeing the 1.75s with the Big Red 12 on there, and I wasn't in a big hurry to grab them because, like they assured us, there was going to be plenty of it, and it was still going to be age dated on the back. Now that this has been announced, I think we need to kind of grab that up. I mean, I don't want to hurt the market myself, but I want to have some just for my own drinking pleasure over the next couple of years. Another funny thing about Elijah Craig 12, I just noticed this the other day on my counter, like where we have some of our spices and so forth at my house. My wife and I keep our kosher salt in an Elijah Craig bottle. And I think that's actually the first Elijah Craig bottle I ever had years ago. I was like, this is a cool bottle, and I kept it. And that's years fantastic. Later, it's still sitting there. There's no label, so I can't see the Big Red 12, though.
Well, I think it's a more just a symptom of what's happening in the bourbon market these days, you know, unable to keep up with demand, especially with aged spirits. I'm sure that what they'll be putting out will be fine, but I honestly would be perfectly happy drinking an Evan Williams or an Evan Williams white label bonded version at half the price. If it's going to be an 8-year-old whiskey, well, I'd rather drink something that's 5 to 7 for half the price and still pretty tasty. So, hats off to the old Elijah Craig. The king is dead. Long live the king.
Yep.
moving on. So we don't want to have people have to listen to us for an hour and a half.
Sure.
We really, one of the main topics we want to touch on today before it becomes too stale is a trip that Modern Thirst made back in October. And this one is beer-centric, and something we've been talking about for a long time because Matt and I, we both hit the big 4-0 here in the last couple of months. And we had kind of decided, since we've known each other for quite a while now, since we were, 18, I guess, our wives and I had talked about doing some sort of a trip to kind of celebrate those 40th birthdays. And what we landed on was a trip to Asheville, North Carolina. If you're into beer, you probably are aware of Asheville, North Carolina. It is kind of the Napa Valley of beer for the eastern United States. And I got to be honest, I had a fantastic time. I thought it was a great trip. And Asheville itself is and the beer scene there is just unreal.
It was amazing. We talked about a lot of different places to go, and Asheville was almost thrown out there at the last minute, and I don't think we could have picked a better place. It's a, as you stated, it's a beercation, or we went beering in Asheville. Yeah. That's what it was.
Beering in Asheville, I think, was our our refrain. Now, keep in mind, it was a beercation, so there were very few moments during said trip where we were 100% sober. So a lot of things seemed awful funny to us then that probably don't make a lot of sense to other people.
Yeah, thanks to our lovely wives for dealing with us.
Yeah, they did, and my wife Jenna actually I think did a lot of the logistics of planning the hotel stay, and it was really great. We stayed in the I believe they were the Biltmore Villas at the Biltmore Village in downtown Asheville, and it was a really great location. The places we stayed, the actual room that we rented was big two-bedroom. Gosh, it was probably 1,500 square feet or more. But it was massive, and it was really nice. It was really fun. It was just off the main road, and there's a lot of traffic in Asheville, so you don't really want to be right on a main road anywhere. But we learned very quickly to use Uber to go anywhere we wanted to go. There's a lot of places where there's multiple, you know, four or five breweries within walking distance, but all of those little clusters of breweries are a little bit spread out in the city. So in order to get around all of them, you don't want to drive. If they're very winding roads, Asheville's out in the middle of the mountains, and Uber's the way to go. There are a ton of Uber drivers. They're all pretty nice, and they're all pretty knowledgeable about the breweries and beers because, I mean, I have to assume other than actually seeing the Biltmore mansion itself, that's probably the number one reason people are coming to Asheville these days.
It's almost like it's a beer town.
It really is. It really is. It's kind of to beer what Louisville has become to bourbon. You know, tourism in Louisville is so geared around bourbon these days. Everyone's opening a micro craft distillery downtown, and the same thing is happening in Asheville, where there's a lot of very industrial working craft breweries and some really good beer over this trip that we got to sample from these places. The one thing I'll say about Asheville is if you want to fill a growler, just buy one there. I don't know if it's North Carolina state law or not, but it is the most convoluted and difficult process to bring your own growler into a bar or a filling station and have them fill it. They have to sterilize it 400 times and measure it and stand on their heads and recite a poem or something like that before they'll actually fill the growler.
That one bottle shop was a little off, but I don't know if that's the true everywhere. We didn't fill many growlers, but be safe and just buy it there, and then you'll have a cool souvenir too.
Yeah, and don't put stickers from beer companies on the growler because they need to be able to see through the glass for some reason in Asheville before they'll fill it. So don't bring a stainless steel and don't put stickers on your glass one. So the different breweries that are there's probably, 20, at least 20 breweries or major brew pubs in Asheville. And there were a few of them we didn't get a chance to see, and that the biggest of which, and I guess you would say the most disappointing to me, was the Sierra Nevada. They have a really state-of-the-art, shiny, I guess you would even say tourist-centered brewery, but it's outside of the city, and again, Asheville's in the middle of the mountains, and if something is just a couple miles outside of the city, that could be a 30-minute drive winding through the hills and going up and down the mountains to get there. So we didn't get a chance to see that, and we didn't see New Belgium, and we didn't see Highland. All of those are beer labels that I like a lot. Sierra Nevada being the label that I probably care about the least, but the brewery that I wanted to see the most.
Yeah, our friend Chuck went there a few months before we were there, and he definitely recommended it, sent a lot of pictures, but in the end, we didn't think it was worth the trip because we had so many great breweries around us. And I think we had trouble even getting in or getting a reservation for a tour. So,
yeah, they were booked up. It, you know, I've seen videos of it online. It looks like a pretty impressive facility. And maybe next time we go, because we'll definitely have to do this trip again. But maybe next time we go, we'll make sure to hit the ones that we didn't see. Of the ones we did see, we thought we'd do a quick rundown, though. Just kind of give our general impressions. We went to Green Man. I don't know about you, Matt. I wasn't real thrilled with it. I didn't think the facility was very nice itself. The beer it was at best mediocre. I did have a porter that was okay, but there was nothing about the brewery, nothing about the beer stood out to me.
I agree as well. I was actually kind of excited to go there when we stopped by there. I walked by it when we were at another brewery at one point, just checking it out, and it looked cool, but once we got in there, I almost felt, I hate to say this, but it didn't feel like the cleanest place. You know, I don't question their sanitation or anything like that, but it felt a little older, and I think that just kind of was in my head too, and I just didn't enjoy the beers as much either. I only checked into one beer there, and that was another problem with my wife was much better at checking into beers. I was not because I would. Anyway, the beer I checked into there was the Opal Pale Ale. And I don't think I even rated that. I had to have. But it was.
Yeah, I don't remember us really enjoying anything there. And again, like you said, I was just kind of uncomfortable. I felt like I was sitting in someone's garage drinking a beer. And while it wasn't dirty per se, it just wasn't. It just wasn't very aesthetically pleasing, in any way. And I don't really expect that much out of a brewery. I think an industrial setting for a brew pub, not a brew pub, but a tasting room at a brewery is kind of the norm. But this was just, it seemed run down, I guess is the only way to say it.
Yeah, I wouldn't say totally avoid it, but don't make it. If you're not going to many, don't choose them, I would say.
Yeah, and a lot of, I guess we should also mention that a lot of what we're going to talk about is dependent upon what beers they actually had on tap that day.
Absolutely.
Because a couple of our Uber drivers loved Green Man, and kept mentioning that that was one of their favorites. So, you know, to each his own. One of the other ones we saw was Catawba. I had heard a lot about Catawba. I'd heard a lot about different beers that they make, but unfortunately, all of the ones that I'd heard about and all of the ones that I was excited to try, they did not have there at the brewery. So there were a lot of different ones that I tried and a lot of them that I thought were pretty average, but I did have. There was a barrel-aged Hooligan Scotch Ale that I thought was pretty outstanding.
They were Catawba was good. They had a couple canned beers that we had from them early on too, and they were decent. Again, we're kind of splitting hairs anytime we are critical of any of these. I mean, we were not disgusted by any of these beers by any means, but yeah, I think they could have had some better selections the time we were there, but I would still check that one out.
I tend to think when you go to a brewery like that, they should have something a little, you know, push the envelope a little, be a little experimental, and I just never felt that at Catawba. It seemed like very kind of general, with the exception of that Scotch ale. I thought it was all kind of run of the mill. Hey, here's an IPA, here's a pale ale, here's a stout. We also went to Asheville Brewing Company. That was really more of a pizza pub. They do brew a little bit of beer on site. I don't remember anything about the beers that I had there. I know I had two or three different ones.
The
But
Shiva.
this was middle of the day, and yeah, I think I was probably already a little buzzed by the time I got there.
Yeah, I remember the Shiva, like from the league, Shiva IPA was good there. They had I rated at a 3.75, so that's. Especially when you're talking about IPAs, going back to what I was saying earlier about it's kind of all relative. So if I'm rating an IPA close to four, it's going to be a good beer. So, but I think I had two of those there because I didn't, or I think I had one of those and I had something else. I was like, yeah, this isn't that great. And so I just went back to that because I was happy with it.
We also saw High Wire. I honestly, I went back through my notes from the trip, and I don't remember anything about the brewery itself. I did have a pretty good review of a Strongman coffee milk stout that I liked a lot, but you know, I think that's one of those that we just kind of we tried. It was fine. Move on.
Yeah, they had like a kind of a circus theme. I think they had two locations. The one was behind that bottle shop where you had all that trouble with filling a growler. Was that called Thirsty? I don't.
I was probably in a bad mood then.
I think that, but we didn't go in that one. I think they had another location as well that we did go into. The I had the High Pitch IPA and I rated that a three, so that's you know kind of a middle of the road beer for me.
So the next place we went was French Broad Brewing Company or Brewery. That was a little bit off the beaten path, I guess. It was kind of out by itself, and I got to be honest. The fact that it was a little bit tough to get to was difficult. The Uber driver we called didn't even they got lost like three times trying to get there and then pick us up after. But I didn't like any of the beer that I had there.
It was more of a. I'm kind of surprised you didn't like it more. It definitely seemed like it was more kind of some European styles. I'm trying to think, see what I have here as far as a rating, but yeah, I wasn't too impressed.
We had a Scotch Ale, a Wee Heavy. We had a 13 Rebels ESB, both of which are definitely a UK style of bitter beer, which typically, I really like English beers and ESBs. And there was just, this is also the first one we went to one day, so it could have been just early in the morning. My palate wasn't quite ready for the onslaught of beer, but I thought the IPA that we had there was fine. We were told to mix the Wee Heavy Scotch Ale and the 13 Rebels to get a heavy Rebel. I just didn't get that. That was the only place we went the entire time where I just didn't feel like finishing a couple of beers.
I did that a couple of times just in the sake of continuing on at other breweries, but I kind of liked the place. It was kind of a small, once I walked in there, it was kind of off the beaten path that we walked in. I was like, oh, this is kind of neat. I kind of thought we'd stay there for a while, but yeah, once we got those, we just each shared a flight with our wives, and they were all fine, but yeah, maybe it was our mood too.
I think there was also an issue that there were a bunch of bees flying around where we were sitting outside, yeah. And that pissed me off.
Yeah.
I may be getting a little cranky in my old age. We also went to Twin Leaf. I loved the atmosphere there. I thought it was the nicest facility of any of them that we went to. Their service was a little rough, but there were some really nice beers there too. The one that still stands out to me was an Imperial Mexican Chocolate Stout, and I know you're an IPA man, and I tend to think that IPAs all start, they're either bitter or not, and they tend to taste a lot alike, but I love a stout, and it was MDXXI, and I don't know if that was Roman numerals for 1521 or not, but it was a really, really nice stout. It was only a 7%, which was a little surprising because I think it drank like a much heavier beer.
That was, I don't know much about my Mexican history, but I'm sure that year means something in Mexican history. I really like that. It actually kind of, because of the name, it made me think of Mexican Cake, which is a pretty sought-after beer that I wasn't able to find down there. But I'm good on the styles. I'm good with about one of them, and that's one that I really did like. So I also had, they had a few IPAs there that were pretty decent. One of them, I don't know if this was experimental from them or not, but it was called 144, codenamed Juicy Fruit. And I can see why they would call it Juicy Fruit, I guess. I mean, it had like kind of that, the fruity, floral type, the hoppiness to it. So it was pretty solid. I think we went back there twice. And the first time, I think we were kind of the same way. We were like, not all their beers are good, but we both found one we liked. And then the second time we went back there, I think I was a lot more pleased with it. I don't remember how we went back there, but it was good.
I think we had some service issues. I remember standing at the far end of the bar for it had to be 30 minutes during it wasn't a huge rush, but the two lady bartenders stood at one end chatting with a group of women over there, and some big, ultra ripped muscle head came and stood next to me at the bar, and it wasn't 10 seconds after he stood there that both bartenders flocked over to my side.
You need to get to the gym.
And take his order at once. And I literally jumped right in front of him and said, hey, I would like an order of the MDXX4QJ, whatever it's called. But yeah, I thought other than that, I really liked Twin Leaf. And like you said, the first trip there, for some reason, I thought it was okay other than the actual facility. The second trip there, I liked it an awful lot.
It was a fun place, really clean. I definitely recommend going there.
One of the places that we went to several times was Burial. And I think everyone in our group, both of our wives and you, liked it a lot more than I did. And I don't really have anything negative to say about it. It was a very urban feel to it, a very kind of a warehousey type, almost garage type of feel, and a big, big variety in the type of beers they had. I wasn't blown away by any of them, but I thought that all of them were good. The locals absolutely loved it. And what I remember the most is that they had a huge selection of really good saisons and farmhouse ales, which was really, I guess, a big part of our weekend was drinking a lot of those. And there was a Saison du Orient, there was a Machete Extra Farmhouse, and there was a Haysaw Saison that I really liked there. And we went back there a couple of times as well.
I love that place, and it's kind of weird when I said that about Green Man being a little bit more rustic and so forth. And I didn't like it. This one kind of had a similar feel to some regard, but I loved it. I could have if there weren't too many other breweries to go to, I could have sat at that bar for a long time or sat out on the patio. That second time we went back, they had some kind of beer fest going on. It was hard to get in,
Yeah, I think
but.
the feel of theirs, their kind of rustic garage industrial feel, I thought was intentional, and I felt like at Green Man it was just kind of the result of neglect almost. And I don't mean this to be a huge insult against Green Man, because again, it had a pretty loyal following of the locals, and that's usually a good sign that they're doing something right. But I'd had no problems with the atmosphere there. I had no problems with the actual bar. And the beer itself was really good too. It was definitely one of the highlights of the trip.
Asheville has obviously their share of hipsters and so forth, and I don't say that in a bad way, but I think that the Burial was the beer of the month there or whatever, the brewery of the month. I think that's one reason it was kind of crowded. The locals talked about it a lot. I think that as many breweries that are popping up there, I'm sure that changes. I bet if you go next month, there'd be another one that people would all really be talking highly of. But with the quality of their saisons and just in the kind of the lineup they had, I think it would be a good staple to the beer scene there for a long time.
Yeah, I thought that they, along with Twin Leaf, had a very nice, very broad selection of beers and beer types. A lot of the places you would go, there's 14 different IPAs or pale ales, and one or two porters or something a little different. And they were just kind of across the board between the farmhouse and the saisons. And it's just kind of neat, a lot of variety. A lot of if you didn't find one thing you liked, I'm sure there was something else on the menu that you did. The alternative to that, however, was the Thirsty Monk, which again is not really a brewery; it's a brew pub. It's a fairly popular place there, from what I understand. They had a great selection of things that they don't make, and the basement pub there had a great refrigerator with bottles and cans of beer from all over the place. I didn't make it to the upstairs bar; I really like the downstairs ones. But I have to mention the Must Love Coconut IPA. That's one of them that they actually brew there, and I don't even know why I ordered it. I'm not a huge coconut guy, and I'm not a huge IPA guy. But when I tried this, it became the single best thing that I tasted on the entire trip.
It was amazing. It was probably what it was very unique, and I wish I would have taken notes when I was talking to them about how that was created. I feel like it was somewhat of a mistake. Like they were getting coconut a porter, and then they had a lot of it left over, so they threw it in there. And I think that is going to be a staple. I hope they continue to make it. It was a lot of fun. Obviously, if you think of a pina colada, you're getting tropical and coconut together, and if you have an IPA that has some tropical hops in there, there are even some of those citra hops in there. Go real well with it, and I do miss that beer. And I love the basement. The basement was awesome. How they had it was just an old beer cellar, so they had a lot of international beers. It was more. They were not a. I wish they had more on tap, both upstairs and downstairs. But we found some unique things, some things that I've been looking to try. So I love that place. They do have a bourbon bar next door too, that we didn't get to.
That's true. That's true. Speaking of things we loved, the last one that we wanted to speak about a little bit was Wicked Weed. And this was far and away the standout of the trip for me on two levels. For one, there's really two different locations for Wicked Weed. They have the main Wicked Weed brewery, and then they have the Funkatorium. And the Funkatorium is where they brew all their sour beers and sour ales. And going into that trip, you had really kind of pushed me to start trying some sour beers, and I'd had one or two. I kind of feel like with sour beers, the first time you taste it, it's not what you're expecting. You don't like it. The second time you have one, you kind of get a little addicted to that flavor. And I had just hit that stage where I had really had the first two or three really good sours before we went on that trip. And we hit the Funkatorium. We hit it pretty early. I was blown away. I hadn't experienced people really getting very experimental and aggressive with sours before that. But they really blew it out of the water for me. And probably the beer that I actually bought the most of to bring back was the Black Angel Cherry Sour, and it's a barrel-aged cherry sour. And it's just, I mean, it's just a fantastic beer. I could sit around and drink tons of it. But you know, singling out a single beer from there is kind of hard to do, actually, because they, you know, everything they made, there was one Java or coffee one that I didn't really care for, but everything they had between the main brewery and the Funkatorium, I thought was fantastic. And you could go to the main brewery, and there were, I don't know, 27 different beers on tap, all of which were made by Wicked Weed or Wicked Weed at the Funkatorium. And I just thought it was amazing. They were all good.
They were fantastic. Actually, yeah, the main Wicked Weed, they had a basement and the upstairs, which is more like a restaurant, brew pub, real nice brew pub. That was actually a converted gas station, if I remember right. But I think they even had more beer, different beers downstairs. But you're absolutely right. The Funkatorium was the highlight of the trip. I actually, that one night after everybody was back at back in Biltmore Village, I took a Uber out to meet a friend of mine that was happened to be in town. And I was like, after I was done there, I was like, I need to go back to the Funkatorium. and if you're not familiar with the sour beers out there, I'm not going to go into all of it. But basically, it gets its sourness from different yeast strains and basically more like natural beer. Or natural yeast, and that's probably what happened. You know, when you're talking about beers years ago, they were probably more sour because they were getting just yeast from the air. So they're using a lot of experimental yeast to achieve these tastes. It took me a while to really get into them. I'm surprised, Bill, how quickly you did. But I think they're a fun change of pace. The other thing the Funkatorium did quite a bit was doing some barrel aging. So I think we have some great pictures of their barrel set up in the back. So.
It looked like a bourbon warehouse back there.
That's absolutely the highlight of the trip. One reason they were kind of busy this weekend, is the Funkatorium, is they have that Dark Arts Fest going on, and we didn't actually go to that per se, but Dark Arts is their like Russian Imperial stout that I had and rated very highly. It was amazing. It's kind of like that Dark Lord thing I mentioned earlier about at Three Floyds. They it's kind of their big release of the year, and it's just a barrel-aged stout, and it's awesome. But when I went back there, they had a lot of different barrel-aged stouts on tap. They had a Bourbon County brand stout from Goose Island, which is always a big sought-after beer and one of my favorites as well. So, yeah, I can't say enough about Funkatorium. We don't want to make a Funkatorium podcast, but we probably could.
Yeah, I think you know, part of what really stood out to me is that it was the most unique of anything that we saw, that any place that we went, mainly because of the sour beers that they had there. But I thought it kind of hit the sweet spot in terms of what you could buy from a beer level. The atmosphere, the actual physical location was well done. It seemed clean. It seemed friendly and comfortable and cozy. All in all, just the highlight of the trip was both the Wicked Weed and the Funkatorium, but the Funkatorium in particular, I just wanted to single that one out. Moving on a little bit from the beer side, since we don't want a 2-hour podcast here, but we just left the bourbon release season right at the end of last year, and I mostly came away empty-handed, and that was really kind of intentional. I'm a little over the idea of hunting bourbons. You know, neither of us actually collect beer or bourbon. We buy it when we see something we definitely want to try or definitely want to review for the site, but we don't really collect it. And we 100% are not on board with the secondary market and flipping. So we don't do any of that. You know, it's kind of I'm coming around to the idea that the best way to try really good bourbon isn't really to wait in line and buy a Pappy Van Winkle for $200. It's to find a really good barrel of something that's usually available on the shelves. And that's not the hardest thing in the world to do, but it's not always that easy either. It basically requires you to become familiar with the different type of store picks that you can find in your area, where a retailer will go in and actually buy a barrel of bourbon, and they'll bottle it up for that retailer, and they'll be the only person who can sell that particular bottle. You can find some really, really amazing ones at times. I know Westport Whiskey and Wine here in Louisville has some really amazing picks, and that's because Chris Zabrowski, who runs that store, he has a very good palate. He's a wine guy by trade, and he's developed a really good palate for whiskey as well, and he picks some great, great bourbons. In fact, the best store pick I've ever had was a 10-year Willett Family Reserve or whatever they call those. That was just, I mean, it tasted like there was maple syrup in the bottle. But a lot of his stuff is really, really good. And along with that, he's also involved with the Louisville, the Bourbon Society here in Louisville. So he heads the barrel selection committee there, and that allows us to get some really, really great barrel selections for the Bourbon Society as well. But that's really where I think, you know, if you're into bourbon, but you haven't really gotten into the collecting or the buying the high value, really expensive stuff, but you really kind of want to try it, I think maybe the way to go then is to the way to go is to really find a good barrel selection of something. It can be something as simple as a standard Buffalo Trace. We have one from the Bourbon Society that's outstanding. And I don't know, Matt, about how it is up in Cincinnati, but I imagine there's some really good ones up in Northern Kentucky.
Absolutely. I love the barrel selections. Actually, that's when I was drinking the Weller Antique, which unfortunately you can't find that very much anymore, but that was my house bourbon for years. And I always bought it from Cork and Bottle, which is basically right across the 75-71 bridge from Cincinnati in Northern Kentucky. And that place went through some changes. There's a whole backstory to why they went through changes, but now they're owned by Gallenstein. And Gallenstein has a lot of liquor stores up in Northern Kentucky, and they do all their picks together now. And they have some fantastic palettes that are picking these things out. So you can't go wrong there. And then back to the party stores, like I mentioned earlier, they have great ones. Our friends over at the Bourbon Guys did some selections with them too. I've been real pleased with what they've picked out too. But back to what you're saying about these barrel selections, at first it almost seems like it's a novelty. Like people are just like, oh, we'll put our own sticker on there and say it's better. But you're absolutely right. There's some amazing single barrels that you're finding. And like you mentioned, Buffalo Trace, you're buying a Buffalo Trace single barrel at the regular price. So gives you some value as well.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And there's been some kind of, you might even call them unicorn bottles out there in recent times. I think there was a Liquor Barn or a Kroger pick recently that was a 13 or 15 year old Knob Creek single barrel that I didn't get. I know some friends of ours who are also bourbon writers, bloggers, and podcasters had a bottle of it and said it was absolutely amazing, and I have no reason to think any different. But that was just a store selection of a private barrel selection of a standard whiskey you can buy on the shelf, and you could buy that private selection for $35. And it, you know, it's going to stand up to any limited edition $300 wait in line, camp out for a week, and flip it for twice that much type of bourbon that you'd find. I will say, and you know, I know, I guess this is a little disingenuous of me given the rant that I just went on against hunting bourbon and whatnot. There are some bourbons that I would probably wait for if I were guaranteed of getting a bottle. I'm not going to camp out for a few days for them, but you know, one of the most perfect bourbons I've ever had was a 2013 and 2012 Four Roses limited edition small batch. They were fantastic. But my unicorn bottle is the William LaRue Weller from the Buffalo Trace Antique Collection. And George T. Stagg is another one that's just up there on that level as well, too. Those are the two that I would probably, you know, get involved with a foot race. Hopefully it's some very slow people because I'm not the swiftest people. But those are my unicorns. Those are the ones that I would have to consider if someone told me, hey, if you show up at 5 in the morning, by noon, I can guarantee you you'll get a bottle. Those two, the William Lee Weller, the George T. Stagg, are probably the two that would do it. It sure wouldn't be a Pappy. I have some bottles of Pappy that I bought back in probably 2003 or 2004, maybe up through 2006. That was some of the older stuff that wasn't Buffalo Trace yet, and it's certainly really good whiskey, but it is, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I'm generally not a wheated whiskey guy unless I can get it at something very different. So ultra-aged, which is where the Pappy comes in, but in particular, I like the higher proof wheat whiskey. So the William LaRue Weller, when you get that barrel proof, you know, it gets well up there into the 120s and above. That's just something that you don't find anywhere else. It's really a very unique whiskey, and that's why I think it's worth waiting for. And then the George Stagg is just a really good whiskey at a very high proof. So other than that, there's probably nothing that I would ever bother waiting in line for.
Yeah, the Old Forester Birthday Bourbon that was my favorite release back in 2014. I wanted to make sure I got it here in 2015. I got lucky enough with a liquor store that helped me out, and I was actually able to choose between the 14 and 15. So I chose the 14, but I've had a tasting of the 15th, and I think I think I was I made the right choice, but that's one that I really will seek out. I kind of would like, I've never had a bottle. I've had a taste, but I've never had a bottle of back to the antique collection. I've never had a bottle of the Handy Sazerac, and I know you're not as big into rye as I am, but I certainly would like to have a bottle of that myself.
We did try the Sazerac in Asheville at one of the little restaurants and bars we were at, and it's really good, the recent 2015 Sazerac. That's a pretty good rye. Again, like you said, I'm not really into rye. I enjoy it. I like it. But I think it lacks a little complexity compared to a bourbon. I think it's a little more one-dimensional. A good aged, especially at a higher proof one, is excellent. I absolutely loved the barrel proof Smooth Ambler Old Scout Rye. I think that, all things considered, proof, price, age, it was just fantastic. And I think that's kind of gone now. I think you're kind of stuck at the lower proof stuff that's been proofed down to around 100 proof, 105, which is still very good. But so to wrap things up, just what you can kind of look for in the future with Modern Thirst in February, I believe it's around February 26th. It's the Friday and Saturday. The Bourbon Classic comes back to Louisville. This is an annual event. It's kind of the biggest, other than maybe the Bourbon Affair, it's probably the biggest festival or gathering of bourbon in Kentucky, which probably makes it one of the bigger bourbon events globally as well. Matt and I were part of it last year. We were on the media tour bus. We were invited as media, which I think is a kind of an interesting term to use for bloggers, but we were invited to ride on a bus full of other writers. We had a couple people from USA Today and then a bunch of other freelance and professional journalists and some amateur bloggers like us as well. We were on a bus for about a week traveling around Kentucky in 26 inches of snow,
Amazing.
visiting distilleries. We got to personally meet with the master distillers and try some really rare stuff. We kind of got shut out of that this year. I think all of the pros found out how much fun we were having, and they've kind of jumped on board. So from what I understand, it's really the big media types are doing it this year, and then us poor lowly bloggers we're kind of left hanging. So a few of us have gotten together, and we now have our own bus doing our what are we calling it, Matt?
It's the shadow bus,
Shadow bus.
or is it the rogue bus? I don't know if we're
Rogue
even allowed to
bus, yeah.
talk about it.
I think the first rule about Rogue Bus is you don't talk about Rogue Bus. So
So we'll probably edit this out of the podcast then.
Yeah, you'll never hear about this, but we'll continue talking about it as if you will. We're going to visit a number of different distilleries on the Thursday and Friday prior to the event. Very similar to what we would have done last year, which you can read about a little bit on our website. If you just do a search for Bourbon Classic or even just Classic, you can read a little bit about it. But we're going to give you a lot of different content, pieces of content from that. Be on the lookout for anything from maybe a Periscope to lots and lots of tweets. Some of them probably won't make sense because by the end of the day, we'll have had a lot of bourbon with a lot of other bourbon people. But we will 100% will be covering the Bourbon Classic both Friday and Saturday as members of the media. That includes the cocktail and food pairing on Friday and then the main events on Saturday. So that's really what we have coming up, and hopefully at some point we can talk a little bit about our consulting gig that we have working on some naming and launching of a new bourbon line.
I will say that Shadow Bus, that Rogue Bus committee is really going to be, I do believe it's some of the best bourbon bloggers in the world. So if that bus results in a fiery death, it's going to be a big loss for the world.
Yeah, I think you're probably right on with that, at least from my standpoint, so. But anyway, we want to thank you guys and everyone who's listening to Modern Thirst Radio, I guess we'll call it, or Modern Thirst Podcast. This is our very first one. Hopefully it wasn't too choppy for you, and hopefully it's a little enjoyable, because we're planning to do a series of these, and keep us in mind if you're bored, if you want to download something to listen to on the train or during your commute. Look out for more podcasts from Modern Thirst. But this is Bill Straub. And Matt Gates is with me online as well. And we want to thank you guys for listening.
Thank you very much. We'd love to hear from you from Twitter, and any ideas you want to hear from us in the future, we want to hear them, and we'll run with it. Thank you for listening.